You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatto, and for the rest of the hour, we're going to continue our discussion of art and science and the tension between the two in a new play, Fallacy. It's the newest play by scientist-turned-playwright Carl Gerassi, an art historian. This is what happens in the play. Quite interesting. An art historian and a chemist clash over the age of a valuable bronze sculpture. The statue is thought to date to classical times, appears to be much younger, though, when tests done by the chemist show it to be a Renaissance cast and not a Roman original. Question here is, does that artistically make it a less precious work of art? But the play is even more complex than just dating a piece of artwork. It exposes and explores the inner motivations of both the scientist and the art historian when they get too attached to their own theories. Playwright Carl Gerassi joins us today to talk about the play and the challenges of bringing science to the stage. We're also joined by the actor who portrays the chemist, Professor Rex Stolfus, and the real-life chemist whose work was the inspiration for this story. So if you'd like to join us, our number is 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. And if you'd like to see a little short clip of the video, we have a video, a little bit of the play on our website. Surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com. You can watch a little bit of Fallacy, which Carl Gerassi reminds me is spelled with a PH instead of a normal way of spelling fallacy. Dr. Gerassi is Professor Emeritus of Chemistry at Stanford. He joins us today in our Science Friday studios. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Also with me is Simon Jones. He's an actor and co-artistic director of the Actors Company Theater in New York. He's the guy who plays Rex Stolfus in Fallacy, and he's here in our Science Friday studios. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Alfred Wendel is a chemist at the University of Applied Arts in Vienna. And the real-life inspiration for the character of Rex in the play, he also joins us here in our studios. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Let me ask you, Carl, tell us, you tell us a fictionalized version of a true story. Tell us how you came across the story and the play idea.
Well, I came across the story on one of my frequent visits to Vienna, city where I was born, and now get back to fairly frequently, where I spoke to Alfred Wendel, who's right here, who is a friend of mine, who is a chemist, a professor of chemistry, and who studied here in the United States. And he started telling me the story one day of this fabulous sculpture that's in the Kunsthistorisches Museum in Vienna, one of the greatest museums in the world. And the fact that over 20 years ago, he was asked, he and his colleagues were asked to analyze it, sort of just a dotted I or across a T, just confirm again what people were absolutely convinced it's one of the oldest Roman sculptures found north of Italy. And then within, well, he'll tell you himself, but within days or weeks, they showed that it couldn't be that. It had to be a Renaissance cast. Now, there comes, of course, the question, is it a fake or not? What do you call a fake? And it's really not that. But I have to say right away, tonight is the premiere at the Cherry Lane Theater, so I'm slightly nervous, not totally so, because I've seen some previews.
I saw the preview. It was excellent.
It was marvelous.
Yeah, nothing to
it
be worried.
It was marvelous, yes. But, see, you in your program, as you started it, the earlier one about the Van Gogh authenticity and questions like this, you're dealing with the subject. And I'm interested in really all my plays and also earlier novels more about the behavioral characteristics of the people who work in these fields, the real tribal culture of scientists on the one hand, in this case also art historians or perhaps even art collectors. Since I've been a collector for over 40 years, particularly of Paul Klee, and there's a wonderful line about Paul Klee in the play, which I won't give away, people have to hear it, I had to bring this in. So I'm particularly interested in this, and I'm talking, of course, in part about my own tribe. I've been a scientist for 50 years. And the idea, for instance, of falling in love with a hypothesis. This is one of the wonderful experiences of a scientist and other creative people. I'm not talking about a scientist, but it's also a very dangerous one.
And this is one of the central themes
and that's one of
the
central
play, is falling in love with yourself, basically.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Now, and then when your love object is questioned or your own love affair is questioned, you have two choices. You give in or you defend it. And that's what I'm really talking about in this case. Mm. Yeah, the other item that interests me very much is what happens, particularly in the case of a sculpture, because in a painting, you'd say, well, a copy of a painting is never exactly the same. A cast of a bronze is in many respects, visually certainly, a clone. Aesthetically, to the viewer, there is no difference. Yet what has happened by this wonderful sculpture now suddenly being declared to be 1,400 years younger. Mm-hmm. And that is another theme that really interests me. But you have here the person, in the case of Alfred Wendler, you could say, who could tell it to you from a horse's mouth. and my last comment, what struck me so much and why I decided to write a play about this, that Alfred, who's a typical chemist like me, felt outraged and partly justifiedly so, that even 20 years later after they've proved that this is not the authentic original cast, they get really relatively little credit by the museum people who come up with an alternative explanation, which I also buy, incidentally, and you get both of them, of course, in my play, without paying very much attention anymore to the chemists. Now, the art historians, of course, felt violated. The chemists stuck their nose into their own aesthetic world. Mm-hmm. So this conflict is one that interests me.
Mm-hmm. Let me move around the table. Dr. Wendel, did you feel that the character portrayed in the play was you? Was it a good?
Yeah, to a certain extent, yes. I mean, if you are the one, I mean, together with my colleague Bernard Pichler, to find out that this, very much honored statue is not as old as it was considered to be. And then you hear first the art historians denied completely that this could be true, that it was a recast. And after there were so many proofs and there was no escape from this theory or from the fact, they tell you they had been known this anyway for all the time, and all your work was not more but just proving and underlining what their suspicions were, then you get outraged, yeah. And you have a lot of revenge ideas.
Well, let me play a little clip from the play. We're going to play a clip from the play with two of the main characters, Lisa Harrow and Simon Jones, sitting on my right, who get into a little bit of a tiff at the beginning, arguing. Simon Jones playing the scientist, arguing about the scientific method as being valid in deciding the age of this artifact.
Your museum director came and asked if we would take a look at your sculpture.
Take a look?
Yes, we developed new chemical methods, got some new top-notch equipment. Well, there's nothing wrong with a museum commissioning a new approach to confirming the putative age of a sculpture.
Putative?
Well, it's not an insult. More often than not, age is considered putative until it's confirmed.
A little exasperation at the end. Sorry about the sound wasn't a little better. Simon Jones, how did you find the character of the scientist? And I say that because in the play, you're described by Lisa Harrow as being, quote, cocksure of yourself.
Yes.
And you act, and you certainly have that character. Is that?
Oh, good. Oh, well, that's a relief. I thought, yes, that might have been the biggest, being self-effacing as I naturally am. That might have been the biggest challenge. It's a great thrill to find myself sitting next to my real-life counterpart.
You have never met him before.
No. Have you? I think they're almost similar, except he has considerably more hair.
Well, no. He looks much more serious and like a professor than I do, I guess.
You're all more trendily dressed.
Were you directed about how to be a cocksure scientist? Did you have any idea what one was?
No, I don't think so. I don't think anyone said, no, you've got to come on, be... Right. Fulfill them. We felt that if she was describing me that way, then they have to decide one way or the other, the audience, whether she's right or wrong. But what was interesting was to find myself suddenly involved in a world of which I knew, I must confess, and I'm ashamed to admit it, very little, having been an English major myself, Cambridge. Mm-hmm. So the world of chemistry has opened wide.
Mm-hmm. And how did you decide how you would model your scientist? What kind of character that would be?
Well, I really can. Actually, Lisa Harrow's husband, Roger Payne, was a very good source. Famous whale scientist.
Right.
That's from him I learned that one carries, not in this case, I see, from Alfred, one's pencils in one's top pocket. And yes, no, don't see that either there. On you either.
I dropped my pocket protector today. So
yes, yes. And there's no way you could describe Alfred as even shabbily dressed. So I think it might be said that I am... well, perhaps an artist's idea of what a chemist looks like.
Carl, you were talking about the play is about our unwillingness, maybe our even inability, to step out outside of ourselves and consider other people's point of views because we're so wedded to our own ideas. Did you find that? Is that true in real life, how scientists operate?
Well, of course, I can't totally generalize, but I would say in the vast majority of cases that happens in your life, and it's in many respects a wonderful experience. Look, it's equivalent to falling in love with a person. Mm-hmm. You think you've discovered her, as I'll say in this case, her, for the first time. You have this idealized, wonderful feeling about her, and other people start telling you things about her that you don't like to hear, that is not consistent with your picture, but for quite a while, sometimes forever, you refuse to listen to it. In other cases, of course, you do that. In the case of science, there's a protecting aspect of this here, because you're in science, we're both very cooperative and we're brutally competitive. And our competitors are also our colleagues. And they, of course, set out to disprove our hypothesis, not of nastiness, mm-hmm. but in an attempt to show that there are no other alternative explanations. That keeps us honest. So even if you fall in love with the hypothesis, which is not correct, look, I suspect you must have had a program on cold fusion, for instance, just to use an example. Well, I think to this day, the original proponent of cold fusion is now in the late 80s, I think, early 1990s, probably still believe that. Fleischmann and Pons, but most people don't anymore. Mm-hmm. But I think that character is an important one because it also drives us to excel. It drives us to prove our point. It is associated with ambition and name recognition, which is very important among scientists, and it is both the nourishment and the poison of our culture.
Mm-hmm. If another, it's one thing to be criticized or even held to question by another chemist, but to be held to question by an art historian on the grounds of your chemistry, that is much more wounding, is it? This is much less professional.
Well, but of course why I picked
it's another
that,
discipline.
I picked one other thing, namely, and I also took a side of the art historian in this case here, namely the question, what does beauty mean? We use that word also in chemistry, but it means something very different. It is certainly not a descriptive quality, it's really a feeling. And the way art historians talk about aesthetics, provenance, I mean, even what you just talked about, the brushstroke visually rather than needing a computer. And mm-hmm. the top-notch art historians take one look at something based on experience from dozens of years and tell you it can't be that. Why? Well, I feel it. I see it. And you have to, most of the time, they're actually right. Now, the scientist wants to prove it as black and white. Mm-hmm. And then once having proved it, it's one of your lines, you're interested in truth rather than aesthetics. Yeah. You're only interested in proving whether that sculpture is a Roman one or it's a Renaissance, period.
Truth is
the art historian says, well, okay, suppose the artist, why don't you worry about who cast it at that time? Why did they do it? What happened with this here? These are other aspects of it. Mm. And I think it's very important to indicate that we're really talking about no black and white, but really gray situation for which there are no black and white answers, but only gray ones.
Talking about art historians and science on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Talking with Carl Gerasi, Alfred Wendel, and also with Simon Jones, our number 1-800-998-2255. Let's hear from Alfred Wendel. You had the scientist modeled after. This was modeled after.
I just wanted to say some additional things. In this play also, the ingredients which would be necessary to have the chance to make a forgery that mm-hmm. afterwards will be accepted are very well pointed out. That is, you need an art historian who has a theory, and who seeks desperately for proving this theory. And then you need somebody who has skills to, in this case, make an object which would come up to the wishes of this art historian, and having also the feeling of revenge, And one of the most outstanding cases in this field was the Van Meegeren fakes of the Vermeers, which also were with the same ingredients. And in this case, Calcherasse also used these ingredients to show why it could go well. You know,
yeah. But, you know, mine is a play. I want to emphasize this. I didn't try and illustrate exactly what happened. Yeah. I purposely never interviewed the art historian because then I really would be forced into really writing a docudrama, and this is a play.
Well, let me ask Alfred, did your story end with you dating the statue, or did it end up you duking it out with the curators at the museum? Did you have a happy ending, or...?
Well, it's still, the statue is still in the Department of Antiquity, which is okay. Mm. I mean, one should not forget that it's very hard for a museum to lose such an object. But there is still some written. There are still some written lines which tell that, due to the knowledge and the competence of the art historians, it was put into the time of Renaissance, and that the material scientific results just underline or prove these suspicions.
Now, I took my daughter Anna to the play with me to watch it. She's 19, very smart. And when we were done, she says, "Dad, I don't understand the ending." I said, "What do you mean?" She says, "It's more about the people in the play than it is about the
exactly.
science in the play." I said, "You got it.
You got it.
You got
exactly.
You know, exactly." 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to Joe in Tucson. Hi, Joe.
Yeah, hi, good morning.
Hi there.
This is Joe, and I'm blessed to be married to an art historian. I am myself am a scientist, work at a university. We're both university folks and have been married for a number of years. So through the years, some of these differences become more and more glaring in how we look at things. But I would like to state that I'm not sure I agree with the idea, not that I've heard it espoused clearly here, that art historians work at an emotive level, and that what makes good art and bad art is emotional rather than logical. Connoisseurship, as I've learned from my wife, is something that can be discussed rationally and logically, and making logical references doesn't imply that the science is wrong and the art historian is not. I think there's logic used by both parties. Thank you for the comment.
All right. Thanks for calling. We're going to have to take a break, and we'll come back and we'll talk about that comment. But I don't want to get anybody started and then have to interrupt where we're going. As I said, we're going to take a break, come back and talk lots more about fallacy with the writer of Fallacy, Carl Gerassi, also the lead, the male lead in it, Simon Jones, and Alfred Wendel is the silent person on the other side of the world who's actually the subject of this play. An excellent play. It's playing here in New York for a couple of weeks. I suggest you get out and see it if you can, and we'll talk to Carl, see if it's heading anywhere else that you can see it. So stay with us. We'll be right back after this short break. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about the new science play, Fallacy, with my guest, Simon Jones, co-artistic director of the Actors Company Theater in New York, and the actor who portrays Professor Rex Stolfus in Fallacy, Alfred Wendel, chemist at the University of Applied Arts in Vienna, and the inspiration for the character, Professor Stolfus in Fallacy, and Fallacy's author, playwright Carl Gerassi, which opens in New York tonight. He's also Professor Emeritus of Chemistry at Stanford University in Stanford, California. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to the phones. Candace in
Hello.
Forest Grove, Oregon. Hi.
Hi there. I'm a biologist myself, and I've always been highly amused by ego investment and pet theories and the damage that it can do. I'd love to ask Dr. Gerassi if he deliberately infused his play with a lot of humor to sort of waylay that problem, and if he deliberately hired Simon Jones because of his exquisite comedy timing.
Well, first of all,
made a lot of people happy here.
Made me very happy.
I have to say, I did not hire. I'm only the playwright in quotation marks.
Oh, only.
So the director, Elena Araros, who is a marvelous director and has led me by the nose, making all kinds of changes, killing all kinds of my wonderful darlings. She's the one who chose Simon Jones, Lisa Harrow, and also Vince Napo and Carrie Heitman, the four actors. But my answer to your question is I did this, and this is incidentally why a fallacy is spelled with PH and not with F. That already tells you something about even the word fallacious can be spelled with PH as well as F, and then it starts meaning something else. And I wanted to, as I do in virtually all my plays and novels, also want to point out the typical male characteristics of in behavior of male-dominated disciplines, of which science, of course, one of the great ones, considering the fact that I am married to Diane Middlebrook, who was a former chair of the Feminist Studies Program at Stanford, you can well appreciate that I'm sensitized, even if I hadn't been that. I'm now sensitized to, of course, the feelings of women towards that kind of behavior. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't help but do emphasize it in there, on both sides of all four people that you have in there. I hope in a somewhat amusing way. I'm sorry that you're in Oregon. My stepdaughter just arrived today from Oregon. She's an assistant professor at the University of Oregon to come to the play. So you can still come. Incidentally, it won't just be playing for a couple of weeks. It'll be playing for months. And if it gets good reviews next week, it'll be extended for another month.
Wow.
So this may be playing for, who knows, for years.
And it's in the Village. It's a great little theater.
Well, the Charlene Theater, the wonderful theater, yep, with a very wonderful tradition.
Yeah. Let me get Simon on. As she says, you've done so much comedy.
Yes.
Was
yes.
it a big change?
Yes.
Because there is a wonderful comedic note through the play.
There
also.
Is indeed. Yeah. Yes. I try to do it with this immense respect. he has, of course, written some very funny things in it, and it is my duty to bring those out.
Candice, have any questions you want to ask Simon?
Well, yes, by all means.
I'm very sad that you didn't get to do the film version of Hitchhiker, given that I know you from the radio and the movie version on BBC.
Oh, golly, you said just the right thing. I didn't even like the color of his dressing gown, did you?
I did the version, and you still cracked me up, sir.
Well, that was, yes. The interesting thing, if I may do a little sidebar about radio,
sure,
is that you can play the same character for 28 years and still look the same.
And play it in your underwear and yeah. No one will know the difference.
Well, we're all sitting around in our underwear now.
Well, I might as well say this play, which yes. has already been translated, opened in London, so right. this is the American premiere, but not the world premiere, it's already been translated into German, and I converted it into a radio play, and it had already been broadcast last year by the West German Radio Corporation under a wonderful title, because how do you translate fallacy spelled with a PH in the German.
Yes, how do you?
And it is translated to a word people, only the German-speaking ones will understand, is Fallstricke, but again spelled with a PH. And Fallstricke is sort of a trap, let us say. And in this case, of course, it's a phallic trap, if mm-hmm. you wish. Mm-hmm. So this worked very well. And as I said, this was broadcast already as a radio play in Germany. Mm-hmm. And it would be great if they did it here. NPR could do that. I can give it to you in English because I wrote it in English and they translated into German.
Well, thanks for calling.
Thank you.
Good luck.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You already have another play that's being brought. I think the LA Theater Works is...
On NPR, yes. Yes. That was my first play, An yes. Immaculate Misconception. This is my fifth play.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, LA Theater Works did that. Actually, the BBC first broadcast it on the World Service in the German mm-hmm. and Swedish and other radios. But the NPR did it in 2004.
And I think they're broadcasting it again next week
or
in
they?
June.
Oh, really? That's not. Well, it's a play about reproduction.
Yeah.
That was the first one of my science and on the theater.
You invented the pill.
Trilogy.
Hmm?
Right. Well, yeah, but in this case, it really was about the impending separation right. of sex and reproduction.
What made you decide to give up science and go into playwriting?
Well, I remember having done 50 years of research. It mm-hmm. isn't trivial. But I want to lead another intellectual life. And in my 60s, I don't want to become a professional smuggler, which you are in a way. But
you are
rather obvious about it. Namely, people you call it Science Friday, they know what you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
I really want to talk about science, particularly scientific culture and behavior, to an audience that is afraid of it, not interested in it, or doesn't know anything about it. Instead of announcing that this is what it is, I say, come read this novel, or in this case, come to an amusing, interesting play. And when it's finished, they actually will have learned something because mm-hmm. I'm obsessively accurate about the type of facts that I use. Mm-hmm. And my first three plays were Science and Theater trilogy. Actually, you had something about the second play, Oxygen, that I wrote with Roald Hoffman, a very famous chemist. And then my third one, which was in many respects the toughest one, which might be interesting, is called Calculus and deals with a famous struggle between Newton and Leibniz, who invented the calculus first. In other words, you don't learn math in it, but you certainly learn something about the behavioral characteristics of most important people.
I think, Carl, you're doing an enormous favor, actually, to those of us who are, if not unnerved by science, certainly puzzled by it, those of us who've led a life entirely in the arts. I speak of myself. I recently received a paper from a cousin who's just been made professor of chemistry at the Missouri Valley College on nitric oxide, which was fascinating, but I understood hardly a word of it. On the other hand, is now making me much more aware.
I go much further.
I understood more about the paper when it arrived since I've done the play than I would have done beforehand.
Simon, I can send you a novel of mine which is called N.O. and is all about nitric oxide. So there you are.
No, I should send it to my cousin.
You actually commissioned a song called Nitric Oxide Rap.
A rap. We did it actually on your program.
I'd love to keep going. I got to get the rights from you for that, to play that again.
Absolutely.
1-800-989. I love that song. 1-800-989-8255. In fact, you do a little bit of your own. You bring up past history in the play, the story that explains why the copy of the Roman sculpture was made in the 16th century, and it's sort of a peripheral little story. Not, you could, if I might be so bold, say you could do without it in the play, but you obviously love that little piece. That is your own little part that's dear to your heart.
Yeah, of course, then I start to become the art historian.
Right.
And I want to actually offer a plausible hypothesis. What happened to it? Why did it? And I did a lot of reading. It's typical of me in terms of research of Habsburg history. Mm-hmm. Because the hypothesis is that the Spanish, the Austrian Habsburgs, made a cast and sent the original to the Spanish Habsburgs. The question is, which one? Why? Mm-hmm. Why was all this done? And I came up with an interesting hypothesis, which is undoubtedly wrong. Well, wrong. You'll never prove it. But it's an interesting one because they're bringing Don Juan of Austria. And you think that Don Juan of Austria ought to be a famous person in Austria. In fact, the vast majority of Austrians don't really know him. They only know him as a hero of the Battle of Lepanto, and he was really belonging to the Spanish branch. But that, so I brought that history in there. And you're going to see something in this play that this is the one thing I really want to indicate, because I've seen the play now in London and other places. And this is work that was done by two people, the costume designer Victoria Tsikon and the projection designer Katie Tucker, who graduated from the same college I did, Kenyon.
I know what you're going to say.
This is an extraordinary, unique way of how two actors have to play a role in 2001 and in 1577, and how they change costume in 2 seconds.
It's amazing.
We won't tell you how,
it's
but
just,
it's brilliantly done.
If you could say the most unique thing, it is the most unique thing I've seen in the theater.
Yes.
In costume changes.
And I was completely flabbergasted.
And I thought, I was wondering who did it. Was this you? This was the costume?
I couldn't believe it when I saw, during a rehearsal they described it, I said, I don't see how you can do it. When I went to the first tech rehearsal a week ago and I finally saw the beginning. You know, there were 6 computers there during the tech rehearsal. I've gone to a lot of rehearsals of theaters. I've never yet seen 6. You know, this is a relatively small theater. There were 20 people there, technical staff running around, all these cables with all these computers for that particular play. It's really brilliantly done.
If any of them break down, I shall just stand there and recite limericks.
Well, we've both seen it, Alfred. 3 of us have seen it. You haven't seen it yet.
No.
Right?
Not here, no. I've seen it in London. And
but it's totally different from the
London
production.
So I'm very curious about
it. I'd like to ask Alfred, if I might.
Sure.
After this scarring experience of your research on this statue and the response, and ending up as less than a footnote, which I understand your goal, have you nonetheless continued this research with other items in other museums?
We have a department of archaeometry, which brings us, which my colleague Bernard Pickler is leading, and that brings us, every week to cases, especially with archaeologists on archaeological sites, you know. That is one of the main things we do.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Oh, vital, I think, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Let's go to Eric in Portland. Hi, Eric.
Hi. It's a big honor to be on the show. I was wondering, speaking of other issues in other museums, if you were aware of the controversy about the Messiah, the Stradivari, Antonio Stradivari violin that's in the Ashmolean Museum. There is this, it's been put forward that it is a fake made by Viome, who actually sold it and was the dealer in Paris that acquired the instrument from Italy. And two teams of dendrochronologists have looked at that instrument. The first gentleman who said that it was a fake had a dendrochronologist look at it and say, this is tree rings, age of tree rings. You match it against a known piece of wood that has a certain proportion of tree rings, and that dates it. And this this particular first one said that it couldn't have been made when it was supposedly made. And then the museum and other people, there's a lot of money and a lot of reputation at stake in this. They got a different set of dendrochronologists, and so it's still up in the air. I just wondered if anyone was aware of this issue, because it's a big thing in the violin world and has been for a long time. People are very, very upset or interested in it, let's put it that way.
I'll ask my panel. Well, first, I'll give them a breath to think about it. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News, talking about the history of art, art history and science. Alfred, any familiar with this?
With violin?
No.
Well, that's a very complicated area, I would say. But I just wanted to point out one thing. You know, it can also be the other way around. Just today, we were looking at the so-called Metropolitan House in the Metropolitan Museum, you know, where the curator, the art historian, was quite sure 20 years ago that this was a fake, you know. And with means of science, in this case, thermoluminescence dating, which was carried out at Washington University in St. Louis, they proved that it was genuine, that it was more than 2,000 years old. So it can also be the other way around. Yeah.
Simon?
No, I was waving my finger in the air saying, gosh, yes, that's a very interesting point. How interesting to see it work the other way.
Yes, Scott.
If you have, I have nothing to add to the violin.
Okay.
But there's one comment about playwriting, because it was implied in your question, why did I move into playwriting? There's one thing that is completely unique to plays that you don't have in either books or in the film. When you the playwright, mm-hmm. finish a play, when you finish a book, it's finished. And when someone accepts it and it's out, it's set in stone. And when someone's made a film and it's out, you can't change anything in there unless you have millions to spend. A play is never finished. And each time it is different. It is not just each time a different production, a different director, different actors, even the same performance. It's not the same. The chemistry between the live audience and the actors is extraordinary. Now, I've had the luck, perhaps, that my first two plays have been translated into 11 and 10 languages, respectively. And I've seen many different productions because I'm still very curious. You know, I'm a new playwright at age 80-something. So that's a wonderful experience, and I can't I know my life expectancy. I can at best be 120 years.
I've got four or five plays still left in.
Yeah, well, I'm right now writing about once every year. But that experience is absolutely extraordinary because it's your baby, and you see what people do with that baby. And in a way, playwriting becomes a scientific process because playwriting or any writing is solitary, and yet playwriting, the eventual result, is completely collaborative. Mm-hmm. And you have actors, dramaturgs, directors, mm-hmm. designers, and so on. And they change that. And their interpretation, if you're not in love with that play, but if you're willing to give it partly away and still know it's your own genes, but they dress it up differently. This is absolutely unique. There's no other art form that has it, with the possible exception, of course, of opera, where in addition you can also sing. And I had this fantastic experience that my play Calculus was converted into a chamber opera and actually was performed to Zurich Opera a few times 2 years ago, and that was quite extraordinary.
So you've got another play or two in yourself, at least.
Oh, I've just finished another one, yes.
Yeah. What's the name of that one?
Four Jews on Parnassus.
And is that coming to New York soon?
Well, it'd be nice. Actually, it's coming to New York next year. Same theater as my preceding play,
right.
Taboos,
right.
That deals with really the cultural aspects of this impending separation of sex and reproduction. Mm-hmm. I'm open to any theater that wants to do my plays, I can tell you that.
Well, they're wonderful plays.
You ought to talk about Redshift Productions.
We'll talk about Redshift Productions. We're going to actually have the production company here in New York that brought your play to fruition here in the city.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
They specialize in science plays. There's a new play that's coming out there called Sea Change that follows yours, and we're going to try to get Roger Payne and Lisa Harrow in. Roger Payne, the whale guy. Everybody knows Roger Payne.
And Lisa Harrow is a star, another star in my
Shakespeare,
play.
And she's a Shakespearean actress.
That's
so we're going to have to say goodbye to all of you. Thank you, gentlemen, for taking time to be with us today. Alfred de Wendel, chemist at the University of Applied Arts in Vienna, and the inspiration for the character of Professor Rex Dolphus in Fallacy. Simon Jones, co-artistic director of the Actors Company Theater in New York, and the actor who portrays Professor Rex there. And Carl Gerasi, playwright of Fallacy, opens in New York tonight. Break a leg, is that what we're supposed to say?
At the Cherry Lane Theater.
Theater, also Professor Emeritus of Chemistry at Stanford University in Stanford, California. Thank you all for taking time to be with us today.
Thanks, Ira.
You're welcome. Kimberly Jones is our technical director. Our audio engineers are Josh Rogerson and Manya here in New York. Greg Smith composed our theme music, and we had help today from NPR librarian Kim Oleski. Surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com, where we're podcasting and blogging. And if you missed any of what we talked about today, you'll be able to see the listen to the podcast of it. Also, we're making a video. This program is on a video that you'll be able to watch by next week and watch us yak it up one more time for your pleasure. So surf over to our website there, where Science Friday's Kids Connection is also available for free teaching materials that we put out with Science Friday. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.